Hello, Bristol Bay. Good afternoon, and welcome back to the show. And we finally have a name.
Yes, after a contentious feud and having to pick something, we have decided to go with By the Bay.
We're going to just start off now. I'm your host, Izzy Ross.
And I'm Tyler Thompson.
Coming up this afternoon on By the Bay, New Haven saw some flooding over the week, and ice jam at the mouth of the New Haven River caused the water to overflow near the city, flooding a portion of the Lower Village on Friday and threatening four houses. But the water is now receding.
All Alaska residents will be required to have real IDs by this fall. We follow up with New Studio Hawk residents to see how the mobile DMV went. It was the state's first.
And we look into the Pebble Partnership's plan to offset the mine's impacts to wetlands, in part by financing updates and repairs to three of the communities closest to the proposed mine. We check in with Lake and Peninsula Manager Nathan Hill about the borough's role in crafting the proposal.
That's all coming up.
We're going to kick things off this afternoon on Lake Iliamna, where an ice jam at the mouth of the New Haven River flooded parts of the community's Lower Village for several days. The water has receded by about 2 feet since it rose last week, and the Lake and Peninsula Borough issued a local disaster emergency last weekend. Borough Manager Nathan Hill was in New Haven on Tuesday. Here's what he said about the situation.
The temperatures have warmed up, you know, substantially 30 or 40 degrees, and some of the pressure that was being held by the ice outside of the river broke free and some holes opened up, and the level of the river while I was over there had dropped a couple of feet.
So the water is receding and no structures have been damaged beyond repair?
No, I don't think any structures have been damaged beyond repair. There were a couple of houses that had water and ice getting right up to their foundations and maybe into their foundations to some extent. And then there's, you know, some other buildings, which were mostly smokehouses, fish racks, etc., right down on the river that were, looked like they were 3 or 4 or 5 feet underwater at one point. But the ice was quite a ways up there.
According to city officials, the smokehouses by the rivers were partially underwater, and the flood also threatened the sewage lagoon as well as sewer lines for residents in the school. Gladys Askoak, New Haven city clerk, said residents near the flood first alerted the city to the situation.
The family called and let us know the water's going up really fast. We didn't know what to do, but there were some guys that went down there with an auger, and they tried to get the water to go a different direction.
Berms put in place to protect that infrastructure have held up, and this week's temperatures were also much warmer than last week, which helped alleviate some of the river's icy conditions.
The state's first mobile DMV is on the move after its pilot run in New Studio Hawk. The Bristol Bay Native Corporation and Department of Motor Vehicles issued almost 100 real IDs and more than 20 road tests for driver permits. BB&C's Faith Andrew in New Studio Hawk was the proctor for both tests. Despite some challenges, she was happy overall with the results.
From experiencing the DMV in Anchorage, it was sort of like that in a small village. We had lots of people lined up sitting around, so it was kind of excited. I went around, made sure that they had all their documents.
The largest challenge was that some residents didn't have proper documentation. BB&C's Martha Anilin worked on the program, and she says they had to turn some people away.
Some people had laminated Social Security numbers. Some people had copies of their Social Security cards. That won't work either because the DMV needs the original documents. For some of the ladies, they didn't have their original marriage certificate, which showed and displayed their name change.
With a 3-day trip to Port Hyden scheduled for next month, Anilin wants to make sure that people know what they need. Tribal Administrator John Christensen is helping with that mission.
We've been helping people print out their tribal cards. One of the requirements is having a physical address, and a lot of people have been using a P.O. box. So we've been changing those over to street addresses and reminding people to gather up all the information well over a week ago.
Port Hyden will have bunkhouses and Airbnbs available for those who travel to the village. Invites were sent out to the Chignecks, Perryville, Pilot Point, and Ugashik. After Port Hyden, the mobile DMV will make a 5-day stop in Illiamna and New Halen. BB&C is coordinating with the Lake and Peninsula Borough to set up the event for students and their guardians.
So it sounds like things are moving along. What were some of the other challenges?
Well, for a first run, it was pretty successful. There were some uncontrollables involved. The state's camera was having issues. The internet connection was problematic at the start, and an intermittent power outage slowed them down. But having those official identification documents is crucial going forward.
Right, and we'll have a list of documents people need to get real IDs posted along with today's show on KDLG.org. The Pebble Partnership has proposed a plan to offset the mine's impacts to wetlands by funding repairs to the wastewater systems in Cocknock, New Halen, and Nundalton, all of which are over capacity. The plan would also rehabilitate a minimum of around 8.5 miles of fish habitat by replacing and or enlarging culverts, and it would clean up marine debris around Amokdadori. Pebble says that it will permanently impact a total of about 3,500 acres of wetlands. The Lake and Peninsula Borough worked with Pebble to develop this plan. For this week's Manager's Corner, I caught up with Borough Manager Nathan Hill to talk about it. The Borough worked with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium to identify the wastewater projects included.
We basically looked at their priority list for water sewer projects in region and found these projects on their priority list. We then approached the villages. And basically, we were putting villages and ANTHC in touch with Pebble and being a conduit for information.
And so you worked with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, that's ANTHC, to identify what repairs needed to happen in those communities?
Yes. Out-of-kind mitigation isn't, we're not setting a precedent with this. And, you know, there are other pieces to the mitigation involving cleanup of beachfront over south of us in Amokdadori and beyond. And then there's also some culvert project in Dillingham, Kingsham, and other areas. But our take on it was if there is mitigation that's going to happen, these areas, Cockanock, New Halen, Nundalton, are areas that are probably going to be impacted the most by this project. And we heard maybe murmurs of mitigation efforts happening a long, long, long ways away from Ground Zero, the place of highest impact. And we thought it was only fair that if we could find projects that benefited communities closer to the project, it made sense. And so we encouraged it. The environment that we live in is relatively pristine. There aren't a whole lot of improvements that can be made as far as making more wetlands or repairing things that have been broken by our presence. And so the immediate populated areas with water sewer projects just made sense. A lot of folks from maybe outside of our region may not understand this. If you're from heavily populated areas, upgrading or repairing wetlands and improvements on those types of things those opportunities are everywhere, and we just live in a place where we haven't made a big dent on that sort of thing, and the only real opportunities were in the water that we use for drinking and or the effluent water sewer.
I think that that's a point that a lot of people would make, you know, regarding the idea of mitigation. Do you think that the compensatory mitigation plan that Pebble has put forward is adequate?
I really can't answer that, whether or not it's adequate. I can tell you what the borough's role in this is as far as coordinating and working to protect our villages and to, you know, encourage the infrastructure improvements, but I can't make an opinion on whether or not it's adequate.
So if Pebble were not to help out with the upgrades to the wastewater systems in those three communities, where would funding for those updates come from, and what would the timeline be?
That's an unknown. These were projects that were on ANTHC's maintenance list. They've got a long list of projects throughout the state, and funding is unpredictable from, you know, state and federal sources. I think these would mainly have been federally funded projects. The commitment from ANTHC was that whether or not these projects are funded and whether or not they do get done underneath the auspices of the mitigation plan doesn't take them off of the priority list. It doesn't mean that they will fall further down or anything like that. We wanted to make it clear that if ANTHC is here first and builds the project, then ANTHC does it. If the mitigation effort beats ANTHC to the punch, then we take whoever does it first.
Are the sewer systems or the wastewater systems in any of those three communities over capacity? What are really the issues that they're facing there?
Yeah, the answer to that is yes. The only reason that these are on the list for ANTHC and or a concern for the borough is that they are at or beyond their capacity. In order to qualify to be on a wetlands mitigation, to be compensated under that, they do fit that criteria.
Thank you so much for taking some time to talk. I know you're really busy right now, so I really appreciate it.
Yep, you bet.
That was Borough Manager Nathan Hill, and we also talked to Pebble spokesperson Mike Heatwall. He outlined their process for developing the mitigation plan, saying that the first step is to avoid wetlands wherever possible and minimize the project impacts. His example was that Pebble had changed its port design from a dredge to a lightering system.
First step is you look, are there disturbed wetlands within a geographic area that you can restore? You know, or are there opportunities to set aside into permanent protection potentially threatened wetlands? And in our case, neither of those applied. So we started looking within the watersheds, both the Bristol Bay and Cook Inlet watersheds, for areas that we could, through the lens of improving water quality and fish habitat, offset our impacts, and we came up with three proposals that we recommended as part of our draft mitigation plan for the Corps to evaluate.
And that's a point Nathan Hill had as well, that Pebble turned to out-of-kind sewer repairs because there just isn't a lot of habitat to restore in Bristol Bay. And again, they came up with those three proposals we discussed just now, rehabilitating salmon habitat, cleaning up debris along the coast at Amokdadori, and the out-of-kind repairs.
How does Pebble plan to pay for these updates?
So Heatwall says that's going to be part of the sanction decision to move the project forward. Here's what he had to say.
Within the cost of constructing a mine at the Pebble deposit, it would include making sure that we have the funds available to pay for all of the projects that are recommended in our draft compensatory mitigation plans. All of that gets rolled up into a sanction decision.
Mm-hmm. Heatwall says they don't know exactly how much the projects were going to cost. He put each project's price tag in the millions, but he did say that Pebble would cover all the costs.
We haven't put any limits on it other than what we've outlined within our recommendation. And, you know, this has been an iterative process up to this juncture, and I'm sure it will continue to be one as this advances. You know, once the Corps takes now a look at the details that we have proposed as part of our draft compensatory mitigation plan, you know, it's now on them to look at it and say, yes, this meets the requirements that we would have for a project like Pebble, and, you know, take it to the next level and approve it as part of the final EIS for the project.
If the mine is permitted, the mitigation projects will have to be completed before construction of the mine begins. And for some context on compensatory mitigation, we're going to turn now to Arielle Wittenberg, the water reporter for ENE News based in Washington, D.C. She's a journalist who has covered Pebble extensively, and yesterday she published an article on Pebble's mitigation plan. What is the history of compensatory mitigation in project permitting with respect to the Clean Water Act?
So the Clean Water Act says essentially that anytime you are going to build a project or, you know, create a project that's going to destroy or damage wetlands and streams, you have to offset that damage. So if you're going to build something in an acre of wetlands, you have to restore or preserve at least an acre of wetlands nearby that serve similar functions to the ones that you're destroying.
Is there anything different about what Pebble is proposing?
Yes. So the biggest difference in Pebble's proposal is this idea that they are going to basically fix up three local sewage systems as a form of compensatory mitigation. That is something that I have not found any examples of happening in any state other than Alaska. And there's only one example of it being permitted in Alaska. That's on the North Slope. It's Oil Search's Nanushuk project, and that was only permitted this spring, so we actually haven't yet seen exactly what will come of that permit in terms of the exact sewage fixes that they're planning on doing up there.
Right. Right. In your article, you outlined this shift in how the Army Corps' Alaska District handles compensatory mitigation, like specifically in the oil search case. Can you talk about that a little bit, that shift?
Right. So to give a little bit of background here, I've seen in the Alaska District basically since 2015 is that they have begun handling compensatory mitigation in ways that are very different from where you would find anywhere else. 2 years ago, I did a story that looked at the permits the Alaska District had been issuing, and they were only requiring compensatory mitigation on 26% of permits between 2015 and 2017. And after that story came out, the Army Corps and EPA headquarters came out with a memo saying, we understand Alaska has a ton of wetlands. 43% of land area is wetlands. A lot of those wetlands are untouched, so it's hard if you're doing a project in an otherwise pristine watershed that will impact wetlands, it's hard to find these offsets. But they came out with this memo to say, so here are some ways that the rule has this built-in flexibility that you can use, so you still can do mitigation even in those instances. So they said either, number one, you can look further away from your project impact to find wetlands that you could restore or preserve. And the other thing you could do is what the memo labeled as out-of-kind mitigation, which is that if your project is impacting wetlands that are important to fish habitat, you can restore a stream that's important to fish habitat. And so even though it's a stream versus wetlands, you're still getting the habitat functions. And so they said that's okay. What the Alaska District has now done, apparently, is said, we are going to say that sewage treatment options and fixing up these systems counts as out-of-kind mitigation. That has no basis in the Clean Water Act, the regulations about how you do mitigation, or this 2018 mitigation memo.
You wrote that James Fugue called the plan a win-win for local communities and the environment, and that's something that we have heard from Pebble as well.
You know, what he's basically saying is if we fix these wastewater treatment system, you're not going to have raw sewage flowing into waterways. Raw sewage is, you know, bad for salmon and for the environment generally. So we're fixing the environment. But the Clean Water Act already regulates sewage systems, and you're not supposed to have raw sewage flowing into waterways, regardless of if you have a big project like Pebble coming in. So the people who should be responsible for fixing up the sewage system are the sewage system owners, or, you know, the state or the federal government providing grants to help them do that in cases where there's, you know, a monetary question there. But to say that you have to wait until a project like Pebble comes in to fix it, that's not really how the Clean Water Act is supposed to work.
Something that I heard from the borough manager was they were working with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium to identify these projects that Pebble would then be financing to repair. And he said that if ANTHC was able to get in there and fix the issues before Pebble was able to, then the communities would go ahead and go with ANTHC. What would happen with Pebble's compensatory mitigation plan if those issues got fixed before Pebble was able to do so?
I think that's a really good question, and it's one that you would think the Alaska District would require them to answer before permitting the project and approving of the compensatory mitigation plan. But again, since they seem to be supportive of these plans, that already there's a big question about whether or not they are legal, it's unclear how they would handle the situation.
Thank you so much for taking some time to talk to us today.
Of course.
So it's the beginning of February, but it kind of already feels like summer in a weird way. And with that come the tourists. But they might be up against some permitting hurdles in Katmai National Park and Preserve, right, Tyler?
Most certainly. The park wants to establish permits to allow folks to use the river corridor. With Brooks River Corridor, I should mention. With visitation at an all-time high, Park Superintendent Mark Sturm says they want to ensure all park goers are safe.
We got a lot of people that are walking around, some of which have decades of experience walking and doing things like fishing among the bears. But there has been a noticeable increase in folks that are somewhat novice in how to behave and how to access bear country. And we see them putting themselves in dangerous situations.
For example, inexperienced fishing in the corridor has led to bears snagging angled fish from lines. Sturm says this can result in bears getting too close to park visitors.
We don't need bears that are attracted to that type of activity. It would cause us to have to take action and manage those bears. And by manage, I mean likely lethally manage if they have a learned behavior that would cause them to come in close proximity to people. We don't want to do that. We're trying to avoid that.
This will be the first time Katmai would require permits to access the corridor. Normally, visitors attend an orientation and are advised to stay about 50 feet away from bear habitat. But if the permitting doesn't improve safety in the park, parts of the corridor could be subject to closures to the public. Other changes will allow the use of e-bikes in the park and extend vehicle parking at Lake Camp from 72 hours to 14 days. A public meeting will be held at Katmai National Park headquarters in King Salmon next Friday, but people can submit comments to the park through February 15th, which is next Saturday, online or by mail.
Earlier this week, we heard that someone is taking the city of Togiak to court.
Yes, a former resident, Robert Ortwick, is suing the city and former mayor Teodoro Pak over his imprisonment in 2017.
So why was he arrested?
Well, he was arrested for bringing a tote full of liquor and a stolen shotgun into the village. Togiak is a dry city, which means alcohol is prohibited. Togiak's tribal court then banished him.
And why is he suing the city?
While Ortwick was in jail, he alleges that he was denied his insulin for a medical condition. He also alleges that he was denied access to enough food and basic hygiene. After 6 days, a police officer and four others handcuffed him and bound his legs with duct tape to transport him to the airport.
Are there any specifics in this case?
Ortwick's lawyer filed 5 counts of emotional distress, including a violation of the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. He will deliver his opening brief next month, and Togiak will respond in April.
All right. Well, thanks for that update, Tyler.
Absolutely.
And finally, this Friday, we're going to head over to the Nooshikak Peninsula. We have a lot of snow right now, but that hasn't really been the case in recent years. Bristol Bay has seen several warm winters. The caribou herd on the peninsula has been thriving, but that means that they're depleting an important food source. Lichens cover the Nooshikak Peninsula. They range from mottled green and gray to yellow and brown, spreading in moss-like patches across the tundra. But as the peninsula caribou herd multiplies, that lichen cover, which used to be thick and lush, is shrinking.
It's decreasing at an increasing rate. That has us concerned.
That's Andy Aderman, a biologist with the Togiak Wildlife Refuge. He's holding a hefty textbook, Lichens of North America. And he started by reading a few basic facts. Lichens can be found in almost every environment on Earth and on every kind of surface.
Soil, rocks, and tree bark to the backs of living insects.
What the heck?
A lot of people refer to lichens, at least the lichens that caribou like, as caribou moss. But it's not really moss.
Lichens aren't actually plants. They're photosynthetic composites of algae and fungi. If they're overgrazed, they can take decades to regrow. Nooshikak Peninsula lichens weren't always fodder for caribou. In fact, for much of the past 2 centuries, there were almost no caribou on the peninsula at all. Biologists aren't sure what happened to them, but in the 1980s, managers decided it was time to bring them back. When they did so, in 1988, lichens were widespread, and their cover was also taller and denser. But as the Nooshikak herd has thrived, that cover has thinned. The warm weather also means that hunting conditions are poor, so there's less of a check on the population. Ideal hunting largely depends on 2 things, frozen rivers and enough snow cover for snow goes to move easily across the tundra.
That's been a challenge, and really 5 of the last 8 winters have not been very good. And that was, you know, when the numbers were high and there's a lot of mouse down there eating lichens and other stuff. And, you know, our intentions were good. But it just didn't work out. I think that's part of the reason.
Locals hunt caribou on the peninsula, but in the past it's been difficult for them to access the herd. Last winter, only 3 caribou were reported harvested, taken by hunters that flew into the area. Moses Toyokak Sr. is the mayor of Manicotic, one of the communities closest to the peninsula.
It used to be good when there was lots of snow and colder weather, but then currently we've been having a mild winter and some places are pretty dangerous to go across. And I wouldn't recommend going down if you don't know the terrain down there.
Warm winters are also changing the ecology of the peninsula, making it more difficult for lichens to replenish themselves. Kyle Jolly is a wildlife biologist with the National Park Service.
Snow acts as a protectant from wind abrasion and trampling. So if there's less snow on the ground, lichens could be crushed by caribou. They also, you know, obviously be more accessible and could be eaten that way. When they dry out, they become very brittle, and so they fracture very easily.
As the summers warm, they are also increasingly susceptible to wildfire. Unlike grazing, fires completely destroy lichens, and that means it could take them more than a century to regrow. This begs the question, what happens to the Nushagak caribou if the lichens are gone? For Alaska's Energy Desk in Dillingham, I'm Izzy Ross.
Wow. I'm so glad we know more about the fascinating world of symbiotic photosynthetic composites, Izzy.
I am so glad, too. And if anyone has any questions about lichen, please feel free to reach out if you're interested in learning more. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with the weather. That's Grazing in the Grass by Friends of Distinction, and that just about does it for the show this week. We're going to take a look at the weather now. It's been a warm week around the region. We've been getting lots of snow here in Dillingham, great skiing weather. We have had a winter weather advisory for the region through tomorrow. Snow and blowing snow is expected with reduced visibility, and we're expecting anywhere from 4 to 8 inches of snow tonight. It's going to be very windy as well, gusts up to 50 miles per hour. We are looking at a wet mix of snow and rain tomorrow morning and tomorrow afternoon. Highs will be in the mid-30s to lower 40s, and Sunday we might see a few showers as well. Over in Naknek, it's currently 25 degrees. Cloudy skies this afternoon. East-southeast wind at 10 to 20 miles per hour over in Naknek. Tonight and tomorrow, it will be windy, snow this evening, giving way to some showers of rain and wet snow later on, a southeast wind at 20 to 30 miles per hour in Naknek, accumulation of less than 1 inch expected over there, and on Saturday, temperatures steady in the mid-30s with a south wind at 25 to 35 miles per hour. Over in Unalakleet, negative 39 degrees right now, very chilly in Unalakleet today, much cooler than yesterday, sunny to partly cloudy with a northeast wind at 5 to 10 miles per hour, a high of negative 23 degrees, and a low of negative 28 degrees tonight, partly cloudy skies during the evening in Unalakleet, giving way to cloudy skies and a light snow after midnight. On Saturday in Unalakleet, a high of 19 degrees and a low of negative 7 degrees, so it is warming up there. An east-northeast wind expected at 20 to 30 miles per hour. Sunset in Unalakleet at 5:51 p.m. Unalakleet will be seeing 6 minutes and 24 seconds more daylight. And in Dillingham, we're going to see a sunset at 6:08 p.m. Tomorrow, we will see 4 minutes and 57 seconds more daylight. And we also will have a full moon tomorrow.
Now, taking a look at some of the community announcements and events coming up. Tomorrow will be the Young Children's Fair, free for children through the ages of 5. Children must be accompanied by an adult. This is all happening 1 to 3 p.m. in the Dillingham Elementary School gym. Naknek Quijack Fish and Game Advisory Committee will meet at Dolly's Hall in Naknek Monday, February 10th for a teleconference. The purpose of this meeting is to hold elections for AC membership and discuss Board of Fisheries proposals and the call for proposals for Central, Southwest, and statewide game. Lake Iliamna Advisory Committee will meet at the Iliamna Community Building in Iliamna on Tuesday, February 11th for a teleconference. The purpose of this meeting is to hold elections for members and officers, discuss Board of Fisheries proposals, and for the Board of Game to call proposals for Central, Southwest, and statewide game. Both of these meetings in Iliamna and in King Salmon are open to the public. On Tuesday, February 18th, from 5:30 p.m. until 9 p.m. at the Dillingham Middle School Gym, Bristol Bay Area Health Corporation will hold an informational public meeting to discuss BBAHC's healthcare operations. Be sure to attend when that happens. Next Tuesday, February 11th, McDowell Group engineers will be back for the Dillingham Waterfront Strategic Plan to discuss more ideas for the final draft. We encourage fishermen to come out and participate in the event. When we were there last time, when they first came through in December, there was some lacking input. So if you fish around the area, and of course, everybody is invited, but please show out.
And we also did get a few requests for information on when that meeting was taking place. So it is next Tuesday, that's February 11th. That's the Waterfront Strategic Plan meeting.
4 p.m. to 5:30 p.m., City Hall, Council Chambers. That's going to do it for By the Bay. You can listen to local news every day at 7:04 and 8:19 a.m. and at noon, or visit us online at kdlg.org. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, give us a call at 907-842-2200 or email us at news@kdlg.org.
We'd also love photos from around the region to add to our web posting of the show. We post it every week, and we really would love some photos. If you're anywhere around Bristol Bay and have taken some cool photos, just send them over our way. We'd love to post them along with the show. And we would also like to thank everyone for the brainstorm on show names. It was your inspiration that has led us here.
Indeed. So some of our favorites that we got submitted to us, Bristol Bay Watch, Bay Briefs.
The Bay in Review.
Beyond the Bay was kind of cool, but
we're following in the footsteps of Bristol Bay and Beyond, so that would be confusing.
Catch up with Bristol Bay, the Bristol Bay Bulletin. You know, keep sending suggestions. I would love to hear more ideas.
Definitely. You know, yeah, we have a name now, but we're flexible.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We're fickle people.
Thank you, everyone, for tuning in today. Stay safe. Have a good weekend out there. Enjoy the snow. And we'll see you back here next week.
Take care.